Hello, everybody. Warren Smith here, and I'd like to welcome you to the Ministry Watch podcast. On today's extra episode, I have a conversation with Aaron Wren on his book, Life in the Negative World. For centuries, Christianity has been seen as a positive force in the world, even by those who are not Christians. But my guest today, Aaron Wren, argues that this perception has changed. In a widely read and widely discussed article for First Things magazine, first published a few years ago, Aaron Wren said that the world up until 1964 was what he called a positive world for Christianity. But from 1964 to 2014, we lived in what he calls the neutral world. And since 2014, we live in the negative world for Christianity. Wren expands on these ideas in his latest book, Life in the Negative World, Confronting Challenges in an Anti-Christian Culture. I've got to tell you that I found the book to be really interesting, and I think you'll find this conversation that I had with Aaron to be fascinating as well. Aaron Wren is a senior fellow at American Reformer. He is a former senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a former partner at Accenture, the global consulting firm. I had this conversation with Aaron Wren last week via Zoom. Aaron, thanks so much for being on the program today. I must say I found your book compelling, interesting, and I'm grateful for it. So thank you for writing it, first of all.
I appreciate the kind words.
Yeah, and the book came out of an article that you wrote for First Thing some years ago. Before we dive into the book, could you talk a little bit about the, you know, the origin story of this book?
Sure. It actually starts back in 2014. I was living in Indianapolis briefly in 2014 before moving off to New York City. And a friend of mine had been involved in creating a set of Christian short films that was called For the Life of the World, which the name obviously coming from the Alexander Schemin book, was done through the Acton Institute. They're actually very good, and you could check them out. They played at a lot of Christian colleges and things. Got great response. And so they were doing a screening of this film series at Indiana Wesleyan. And so I went up there to watch it. And as I was driving home, I was thinking to myself, that was really well done. I mean, those were impressive films, but the world is changing, and the sorts of concerns and ways that they're engaging with the world, targeting these young people, that is going to shortly be obsolete as sort of the world changes. And so I went back and opened up my Word document at home, and I just bunched in a whole bunch of bullet points of things that I saw going on in the culture. And then probably, you know, back in 2017, I actually published the original version of it in a newsletter I was running, my newsletter, which of course now my Substack site at aaronwren.com. And it was the 13th issue of the newsletter called The Lost World of American Evangelicalism. And although I didn't, at that point, I had hardly any readers on my Substack. It was sort of an underground newsletter. But this piece went viral then, and I know Rod Rear wrote about it. It really got a ton of attention even then, and is really what put me on the map then. And then First Things magazine said, hey, would you like to update this? And we'd publish the magazine. So I said, sure. So I made a few updates to it, and then it was published in the February 2022 issue of the print magazine, where it was the most read article of the year. And maybe the most talked about article in the history of First Things magazine. It really made a huge splash. And of course, I turned it into a book. And every time I write the Three Worlds thesis up, I get to refine it because I can respond to sort of the critics, the feedback, you know, the good and the bad, to sort of dial it in a little bit more. And then the book, you know, it takes the sort of Three Worlds thesis from, you know, that I developed, and then adds to that, okay, what should we do in light of the way that the world is? So about 75% of the book is focused on that. It's not just another recapitulation of something that you could have read in First Things originally. It's it's updated. And then there's, you know, there's a significant amount of material about how we respond to cultural conditions.
Well, having, you know, been a reader of First Things and familiar with, you know, with some of the early versions of the book, one of the things that I found to be a virtue of the book was your attempts to, you know, to look at next steps. Well, you know, what are some things that we can do? What are some strategic ideas? And also to answer some of the objections, though you did not explicitly say, at least I don't remember you explicitly saying that, you know, in an earlier version of this three worlds model, the critics said this. You didn't, I don't know that you said that explicitly, but I could sense that level of thinking going on.
Well, one of the things that I did is, And maybe we'll give it a little bit of an overview here in a minute, but I had originally said what I called the positive world in the article and in the newsletter. I said it was pre-1994. And listening to what people were saying, and they would go back and start talking about, you know, things throughout history, I realized, like, wait a minute, that's not really what I mean. When I say the positive world, I'm actually talking about the first phase of Christian decline. It's not just the whole world prior to 1994. It's very specifically a sort of 30-year window of the first stage of decline. So I actually put a start date of 1964 on it and said the positive world lasts from 1964 to 1994. And then prior to that, yes, it was, the world was positive towards Christianity, but we can sort of think of that maybe more as not a term we use in the United States, the Christendom era. It's when, like, we had an institutionalized normative Christian society. Then we go into decline. And what I labeled the positive world is not a time in which everything was going well for Christianity. Quite the opposite. It's actually a period of decline in which Christianity is still viewed positively. So that refinement is an example of one of the things that I did in order to clarify the idea.
Well, since you've introduced positive world, why don't we go ahead and jump into some of the content of the book? And you've mentioned your three worlds model. Those worlds are positive world, neutral world, and negative world. You've already said a few words about positive world, but can you very quickly define what positive, neutral, and negative world means and when those worlds existed? What are the eras you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So for most of our history, we never had a state church like in Europe. But we did have a sort of softly institutionalized generic Protestantism as our default national religion. So again, you go back to the 1950s. Half of all adults attend church every week. We have prayer and Bible reading in public schools. Right? We're adding "In God We Trust" to our money, "Under God to the Pledge of Allegiance," that sort of thing. In the 1960s, this starts to come unraveled, and the status of Christianity in America enters a decline that continues ongoing. And I divide that period of decline of Christianity in America into three eras or worlds that I call the positive world, the neutral world, and the negative world. So the positive world lasts from 1964 to 1994. And again, to be clear, this is a period of decline for Christianity. All is not going well. And yet, Christianity is still basically viewed positively. To be known as a good church-going man makes you seem like an upstanding member of society. People want to vote for you when you run for office. You stress you're a good, you know, church member here. And Christian moral norms are still the basic moral norms of society. And if you violate them, you could get into trouble. Around 1994, we hit a tipping point and entered what I call the neutral world, which lasted from 1994 to 2014. Which Christianity isn't seen positively anymore, but it's not really seen negatively yet either. It's just sort of one more lifestyle choice among many in a pluralistic public square. Then in 2014, we had a second tipping point, another what I call the negative world, where for the first time in the 400-year history of America, sort of official elite culture now views Christianity negatively, or certainly at least skeptically. And, you know, there have always been people who didn't believe, you know, people will say, you know, the founding fathers weren't really devout Christians and all that stuff. That's true. But they and everyone held Christianity publicly in honor. That's what's different today. To be known as a Bible-believing Christian does not help you get a job in the elite sectors of society. And Christian morality of traditional variety is expressly repudiated and, in fact, is now viewed as, in some ways, the leading threat to the new public moral order. And so this has been very, very dislocating for American evangelicals who sort of saw the ground shift rapidly under their feet during this period.
One of the things that you say fairly early in the book that is kind of emblematic of these three worlds are three political scandals. One was the Gary Hart scandal, the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky scandal, and now we have Trump. Can you say a few more words about those three scandals and why they are emblematic of their eras?
Sure. For those who don't remember, 1987, Colorado Senator Gary Hart was considered the leading contender to be the Democratic nominee for president in 1998. The media reported that, he'd allegedly been having an affair with a young woman who'd stayed overnight in his Washington townhome. And the scandal around that forced him to drop out of the presidential race. So in the positive world, a Christian moral standard around, don't commit adultery is in effect. You get in trouble. Your critical career could be over if you violate that standard. Again, by 1998, the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal, Bill Clinton was badly damaged by that. Let's be clear. And yet he survived it as sort of Democrats rally around him and said, his personal behavior, however deplorable it may be, does not affect his ability to perform publicly in office. And, sort of conservatives tried to make the old moral standard stick, but they really didn't. Nevertheless, it hurt him a lot. And then the example I use from Donald Trump is the Access Hollywood tape scandal, which, NBC News had this audio tape from the set of Access Hollywood in which Trump said crude things about women. And they actually had been holding this tape back. They'd had it for months. And they were just waiting to drop it on him, like right before Election Day, we're going to drop the October surprise on him. We're going to drop the bomb. And, kind of in retrospect, it was like a 48-hour blip of a scandal. And, it really didn't affect him. And that's why all the scandals around Trump really haven't affected him, because people are like, wait a minute. We don't demand that people live by these standards. These old standards are gone. Okay. And so now we want to wheel them out to try to get Trump. But in fact, it doesn't work that way anymore. And so I feel like, Donald Trump is in a sense emblematic of the cultural changes. I mean, something people don't even talk about with regards to him is that he had been a casino owner. Gambling was still mostly illegal, in the United States when he was in the casino business back in the positive world. State lotteries were coming along, but Atlantic City was like the first new expansion of gambling in a long time. And, the gambling, like a lot of vices that are now normal in our society, was considered the province of the mob, right? And if you were involved in the casino business, you were probably mobbed up. So the idea that Trump, as a casino guy, would be considered like a credible presidential candidate in, say, the 1990s, I think people would have taken a look at that and said no. And, Trump has been talking about running for president since like the late 80s even. He's been talking about it a long time. And he had that sort of like weird Reform Party thing. Wasn't really serious. But he knew in 2015 something had changed and that it was now possible for him to become president in a way that it was not possible in the past. And then he came down that escalator.
So those three scandals are sort of emblematic of the positive, neutral, and negative world. One of the things that you said a few moments ago, Aaron, was that in light of that, evangelicals have been dislocated. They've been disoriented. They have been struggling with how to respond appropriately to life in the negative world, and it has created, if I'm reading your book right, it has created three primary responses. Now, I want to be clear, those responses are not necessarily new. They've been with us a while. In fact, I'm going to ask you to locate these responses in the context of others who have talked about them in the past. But those three responses that you identify are the culture war posture, the seeker sensitivity posture, and the cultural engager or the cultural engagement posture. First of all, do I have you right? I mean, am I reading your book accurately? And can you say a little bit more about each of those three strategies?
Sure. So when I lay out this cultural diagnostic, I then ask, how have evangelicals responded to this period of decline for Christianity? And I don't really say this in the book, but in effect, evangelicalism is a product of the period of decline of Christianity. So if you go back to the 1950s, we were really a mainline dominated society. And church attendance started to decline. The mainlines went into decline. They started losing people. And they were never able to successfully adapt to these cultural changes. And they still haven't, which is why they're sort of coasting into oblivion, albeit in many cases with tons of money.
Well, the mainline's way to adapt has just been appeasement, has been accommodation.
Yeah, so they've sort of just came along with the cultural currents. Now, evangelicalism sort of filled the void that the mainlines left behind, because evangelicalism was much more adaptable and able to, you know, take account of the changing times and attract people. And I say that during the period of my three worlds, there were basically three evangelical strategies, two from the positive world, one from the negative world. So in the positive world, we have culture war and secret sensitivity. In the neutral world, we have cultural engagement. So the culture war is the religious right that we all know. It got started in the 1970s with people like Jerry Falwell. You can think about Pat Robertson. And they saw the culture going in a direction that they didn't like. And their response was, we are going to mobilize politically to fight back. We're going to take back the country through political mobilization. And I think the very name of the leading organization of that era, the paradigmatic cultural organization, Moral Majority, just speaks to a positive world. You would never create an organization today called Moral Majority. Now, it may not have been true even then that, you know, sort of evangelicals were a moral majority in America, but it was at least a plausible claim, like Nixon's silent majority. And so that's what they did. Now, again, if you go back to the 70s, evangelicals were originally Democrats. You know, Jimmy Carter was the first evangelical president. And, you know, you may recall there's a lot of angst over what it would mean for this Bible thumper, Carter, to be in the White House. But this culture war movement, and it was part of a broader movement within political conservatism called the New Right. I don't need to go into that all right now. But basically, they realigned into the Republican Party and became essentially the largest and most critical voting bloc of the Republican Party. And this religious right impulse is definitely still with us today. The second strategy was secret sensitivity. It was pioneered by people like Bill Hybels at Willow Creek Church in suburban Chicago, and then Rick Warren at Saddleback Church in Orange County. And, you know, these folks kind of saw that people weren't going to church either, and their response was, let's build a church they'll actually attend. So the origin story of Willow Creek is that Bill Hybels went door to door in suburban Chicago, knocking on doors, asking people why they didn't go to church. As he said, I got an earful. And he's like, well, why don't we design a church to answer the objections? So we'll have, you know, we'll get rid of all these stodgy denominational distinctives. You know, it'll be more informal, contemporary music, topical therapeutic sermons, et cetera. Again, very successful at reaching emerging baby boomer suburbia. And is, you know, still with us today is the, you know, non-denominational suburban megachurch that we all know. You know, maybe they're not all purely seekers, it would be defined today, but I think the idea of kind of the suburban megachurch model is the inheritor of this. And it built on some previous things as well. It didn't just spring fully formed from the brow of Bill Hybels. I don't give that impression. You know, there was the Jesus movement. There was, you know, Robert Schuller. There's a bunch of antecedents, but I just sort of date it to that. And then in the 1990s, we saw the emergence of a third strategy called cultural engagement. And I think there are a couple ways to think about cultural engagement. One is as a seeker sensitivity for the cities. You know, just as Hybels and Warren reached baby boomer suburbia, the cities were coming back in the 90s under mayors like Rudy Giuliani. You know, crime collapsed. New York and MBA become hip. And so this group of people reached an urban audience in a way that, you know, Hybels and company reached a suburban audience. Another way to think about it is as the opposite of the culture war. Rather than fighting with people all the time, they're like, why don't we take advantage of this pluralistic public square? Just have a conversation. Why don't we talk to people? Why don't we sit down and talk? And, you know, if we articulate the gospel in a compelling way, maybe we'll win some converts. So you can think of, I say Tim Keller of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York was really paradigmatic in creating this model. And again, if I were to write it today, the other one I think you'd really put in there is the emerging church, which kind of got going really in the 90s. And I think it's interesting. It was often referred to as a conversation, you know, the emerging church conversation. And I think that's how this whole idea of that is very, very a neutral world, kind of the currents that were going on in that kind of 1990s era. And again, so you could think of this as, you know, kind of the urban church or college town church today. So those were the three models. And then we get to the negative world. And the question is, what's the model for the negative world? And the answer is there hasn't been one. And so that's kind of been the challenge. We have all three models kind of still with us. You know, which weren't just different strategies. They were a different group of people. We don't need to go in all into that. It's more in the book. But I think there was kind of been an inability to reckon with the negative world. The one idea that was put forth for the negative world was Rod Dreher's Benedict option from 2017, which evangelicals basically rejected. I mean, I think a lot of Catholics rejected it too, but you know, the idea was considered too alarmist. There's a lot of things about it people didn't like. And, you know, maybe there are some legit critiques from an evangelical perspective. You know, Rod is Eastern Orthodox. He'd be the first person to tell you he doesn't know anything about evangelicals. So, like, having a monastery feature prominently in the book probably didn't help with the evangelical audience. But I think there was sort of a sense of denial at that time. And so, you know, kind of that kind of leaves us, I think, this kind of lack of strategies for the negative world, I think, has produced some of the evangelical turmoil that we're seeing.
That, well, that said, Aaron, as I read your book, and again, I want you to correct me if I'm not getting you right here, I do get the impression that while you see, you know, virtues and weaknesses of all three of those strategies, the cultural engagement strategy is one that at least I came away from reading your book feeling like you had a lot of sympathy for, that you felt like that was the closest, it may not be the strategy for the negative world, but it was the closest one that we have developed so far for the negative world. Am I making that up? Did I read that into the book?
Let me put a twist on it. There's a lot that I like out of them. I actually think they are the most vulnerable to the change of the negative world. So keep in mind, their approach was sort of predicated on having conversations with people a little bit. And unlike the culture war people, were never popular. They were always in kind of backwater locations. They didn't have a lot of social cachet. So the truth is, you know, another article about Christian nationalism attacking them or whatever, that's the same article that's been run for the last 40 years, you know, complaining about them. Whereas, you know, the cultural engagers, they're in big elite cities. Some of them work in like high profile positions. They're exposed to a lot of pressures and a lot of risks. And, you know, what happens when nobody wants to talk with you or engage with you, you know, somebody like Tim Keller, I think, was really perceived as having cracked the code on how to be authentically Christian, completely Orthodox, and yet the way you express Christianity, the way you conduct yourself is sort of acceptable to the mainstream. I mean, he gave a talk at Google, you know, one of the times. You know, he had sit downs with Nicholas Kristof, you know, of the New York Times. And, you know, if something were to change such that, you know, you were now viewed as just another fundamentalist, you know, that's like, you know, it's like an issue. And again, I use the example in the book of how he got canceled at Princeton Seminary. This sort of like, you know, it's a PCUSA seminary, but it's not been considered especially liberal, maybe one of the more conservative, I think, seminaries in the PCUSA. And then you can think of what happened to like a guy like Robbie George. I think he's a Catholic, obviously, you know, Catholic professor at Princeton, I've never met him. Everybody says he's the nicest guy you'd ever met. His public persona is absolutely like very charitable to others and all that. Somebody literally brings him to lunch at a dining at one of the Princeton dining clubs. And it's like, they have to change their rules to like prohibit guests like him because he makes people feel unsafe. Robert George makes you feel unsafe. Like, what's going on here? What's happening is that even the most, the people who are the most, call it aligned in common now are just getting attacked like everybody else.
Yeah.
And so like, what do you do in that environment? I actually think there's a more fundamental challenge to that model than a lot of others, although they're all suffering. You know, I think the culture war, for example, has to deal with the fact that their positions are demonstrably unpopular. So yeah, you're going to lose. There's challenges facing each one. But I do think, I would not say that the cultural engagers had it right. They were really effective in a particular era, and they had it right for that era. Now that we're in a new era, they have to figure out how to adjust what they're doing, or, you know, they're going to have issues too.
No, I get that 100%. And I took away from your book that you were not wholeheartedly endorsing any one of those three strategies. But I will say that I did get the sense that you had more sympathy for the cultural engagers.
You know, this is the thing, like, you know, when I updated it, if you went back, there's things that were in the 2017 article that didn't make it into the First Things article. And I was living in New York City. And, you know, I grew up in rural Southern Indiana, and I attended an Assemblies of God church, very culture war, end times, kind of, you know, the whole deal. And then, of course, much of my adult life I spent in Chicago and New York, in a Presbyterian church. And so, you know, I have a foot in, I think, both of those camps. You know, I'm actually less personally familiar with the megachurch model. I've never been a regular megachurch attender. But, I said in 2017, you know, my personal inclinations are aligned with cultural engagement because I like being in big cities. You know, I like the culture of big cities. I'm not, I used to go to the Metropolitan Opera once a week. I would take walks in Central Park. You know, I enjoyed the life of the city. And so I definitely can relate to the idea of wanting to be part of that and engaging with that and identifying with that in a positive way, you know, not the negative way that, again, the Falwells and Robertsons related to American culture. They were sort of very hostile to what they saw as the mainstream culture. Whereas I think the cultural engagers, and I would put myself in here, tend to be more positive to a lot of aspects to it, in such as the life of the mind, the arts, things of that nature.
One of the things that you say is an indication of the limitations of all three strategies, including the cultural engagement, is the rise of such figures as Jordan Peterson and Joe Rogan, that they have, that unlike the cultural engage, in some ways they're almost like a hybrid of the culture warriors and the cultural engagers. In other words, they are in, both of them in mainstream culture, and yet they are pretty dogmatic in their declarations. Certainly Jordan Peterson is, maybe Joe Rogan less so. But can you say a little bit more about both the rise of folks like Jordan Peterson and Joe Rogan, and, you know, the extent to which we can really look to them as Christians to be a model for a way forward in the negative world?
Yeah. So I was actually a writer on urban policy. And what got me interested in evangelicalism at all was, a decade ago, I saw that young men, especially, we're turning to online influencers. You know, there's always been all this hand-wringing about why men don't go to church for a long time. And then I saw the rise of these sort of online influencers, and they were just getting hordes of young men coming to them. This was before Jordan Peterson even came on the scene, and these guys were still pretty small at the time. You know, the biggest of them probably had in the hundreds of thousands of followers. But I saw this as a real phenomenon. And then, of course, if anything, it's only exploded. And I say, you know, when the church does so poorly at attracting men on the whole, and yet we see these online influencers like Jordan Peterson, and he's just one of many, right? They who've attracted millions in some cases, but there's like a whole pyramid of them on down. Many, most of whom we've never heard of. You know, there are people we've never heard of who get 500,000 views on their YouTubes. You know, so wow, isn't that kind of embarrassing? Like, how did someone like Jordan Peterson crack the code on connecting with young men, and the church didn't? And so, to me, it shows that there isn't this sort of indifference to what's going on in the world. But a lot of people out there are actually hungry for guidance in life. They sense that, like, all is not well with their life, all is not well with the world, and they're not getting what they're looking for from sort of the mainstream institutions and figures. And so they're turning to the Jordan Petersons of this world to be their guide to culture, to be their guide to spirituality, to to be their life coach, their guru, in a sense. And so, I said, I think we need to engage. And so I that was one of the things that got me into this, and it kind of expanded from there. But, Jordan Peterson, one of the things that first put him on the scene was a series of lectures he gave on Genesis, the book of Genesis. When these came out, probably like 2014, 2015, he ended up like a couple hundred thousand views on these videos. And I remember when I first found him and I saw these videos, I'm like, this guy gave a series of like 10, 2.5 hour lectures on Genesis, and he's got hundreds of thousands of people watching this. And what's going on? And like, now he's taken all of his religious stuff, he's packaged it into a book called We Who Wrestle with God. It's coming out this fall. He's doing a national tour. I went to it. It was in Indy, a 2,500 seat theater, sold out. People paid, over $100 minimum to get into the place to listen to Jordan Peterson give a sermon on Genesis 12. Okay, so, people are paying money, big money, to hear Jordan Peterson talk about the Bible. And like, wow, we should be embarrassed that we're not winning. And I'm not saying I endorse all that, but like, there seems to be a remarkable lack of interest in figuring out what's going on there.
Well, and one of the things that you say towards the end of the book, and I've got to just stipulate for the record, Aaron, that we're not going to be able to fully unpack all of the recommendations and suggestions that you make in the book. Yeah. But one of the things that you do say, and I think we probably ought to end on this, is that life in the negative world, rather than causing despair, if we look at it properly, gives us tremendous opportunities to love our neighbors. That to use Richard Weaver's old expression, if ideas have consequences, bad ideas have victims. And there are lots of victims in the negative world who are looking for answers, and Christians have those answers if they can just learn how to communicate to their neighbors in the negative world. That seems to be sort of the takeaway lesson from the last, say, third of your book. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that. I mean, there's going to be new and different forms of opportunity to carry out the Great Commission in the negative world. And again, I think Jordan Peterson shows that. People are hungry for guidance. And, I think, call me crazy, we have a pretty compelling answer on that. So I think that's the case. I also think there is going to be a lot of suffering, particularly because of what the world has been doing. We know the opioid overdose deaths. Oh, let's legalize pot. Now we're going to have a ton of kids got problems with pot. Oh, let's legalize gambling. Now we're going to have a lot of people with trouble with gambling. And when you're dealing with major life dysfunctions, of course, the church has always, had a passion for helping people who are in those situations. And unfortunately, there's going to be a lot of them on account of what's going on in the world. So there's going to be opportunities there. I think there's going to be intellectual opportunities. Just the, if we are able to, again, adapt correctly to this world, how to show people, like, hey, it's, you look at the falling family formation rates and like numbers of people who aren't having kids. It's not because most of them are saying, I never want to get married and have kids. Actually, most of them still do want to get married and have kids. It's just not happening. Can we show people, like, oh, here's how you actually can have a successful family life in a society that militates against that? So those are things I would say we should look at.
Well, Aaron Wren, your book, Life in the Negative World, Confronting Challenges in an Anti-Christian Culture, is, again, let me just say, I found it very nourishing and much more robust than we can unpack in a 30 to 40 minute conversation. But I hope maybe we've whetted some appetites and folks will go grab your book. So thanks a bunch. And let me just ask one final question. Anything you want to share with our listeners that maybe I'm not smart enough to ask you?
Just be sure to sign up for my newsletter at aaronwren.com. Go there, sign up, get on the list. You'll have all the content it'll just be blasted out to you.
Very good. Excellent. Well, Aaron Wren, thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening in on my conversation with Aaron Wren. His latest book, the one we've been talking about today, is Life in the Negative World, Confronting Challenges in an Anti-Christian Culture. Before I go today, a quick note that it's, of course, a new month, May, and we have a new book that we'd like to share with you. Caitlin Beatty's Celebrities for Jesus is a book that is right in the center of the bullseye for Ministry Watch readers. It discusses how and why the evangelical church has become so addicted to celebrities, celebrity pastors, celebrity ministry leaders, and how that trend is hurting the church and what we can do about it. We'll send you that book as our thank you for an gift of any size to Ministry Watch during the month of May. If you want to give, just go to ministrywatch.com and hit the donate button at the top of the page. The producer for today's program is Jeff McIntosh. We get database, technical, and editorial support from Casey Suddeth, Stephen DeBerry, Christina Darnell, and Kim Roberts. It's been great to be with you today, and I hope you'll join me and Natasha Cowden for our roundup of the stories that we've been following this week here at Ministry Watch. You can hear that on Friday. Until then, may God bless you.